Disc 6.
Then I think a double for two will be enough.
Don't talk to him, Brett said. Mike must have been in bad shape, she said on the stairs. We passed Montoya on the stairs. He bowed and did not smile. I'll see you at the cafe, Brett said. Thank you so much, Jake. We had stopped at the floor our rooms were on. She went straight down the hall and into Romero's room. She did not knock. She simply opened the door, went in, and closed it behind her. I stood in front of the door of Mike's room and knocked. There was no answer. I tried the knob and it opened. Inside, the room was in great disorder. All the bags were opened and clothing was strewn around. There were empty bottles beside the bed. Mike lay on the bed looking like a death mask of himself. He opened his eyes and looked at me. "Hello, Jake," he said very slowly. "I'm getting a little sleep. I've wanted a little sleep for a long time. Let me cover you over." "No, I'm quite warm." "Don't go. I haven't gotten to sleep yet." "You'll sleep, Mike. Don't worry, boy." "Brett's got a bullfighter," Mike said. "But her Jew has gone away." He turned his head and looked at me. "Damn good thing, what?" "Yes. Now go to sleep, Mike. You ought to get some sleep." "I'm just starting. I'm going to get a little sleep." He shut his eyes. I went out of the room and turned the door to quietly. Bill was in my room reading the paper. "See, Mike?"
"Yes." "Let's go and eat. I won't eat downstairs with that German head waiter. He was damn snotty when I was getting Mike upstairs." "He was snotty to us, too. Let's go out and eat in the town." We went down the stairs. On the stairs, we passed a girl coming up with a covered tray.
"There goes Brett's lunch," Bill said.
"And the kids," I said. Outside on the terrace under the arcade, the German head waiter came up. His red cheeks were shiny. He was being polite.
"I have a table for two for you gentlemen," he said.
"Go sit at it," Bill said. We went on out across the street. We ate at a restaurant on a side street off the square. They were all men eating in the restaurant. It was full of smoke and drinking and singing. The food was good and so was the wine. We did not talk much. Afterward, we went to the cafe and watched the fiesta come to the boiling point. Brett came over soon after lunch. She said she had looked in the room and that Mike was asleep. When the fiesta boiled over and toward the bull ring, we went with the crowd. Brett sat at the ringside between Bill and me. Directly below us was the callejón, the passageway between the stands and the red fence of the Barrera. Behind us, the concrete stands filled solidly. Out in front, beyond the red fence, the sand of the ring was smooth, rolled, and yellow. It looked a little heavy from the rain, but it was dry in the sun and firm and smooth. The sword handlers and bullring servants came down the callejón, carrying on their shoulders the wicker baskets of fighting capes and muletas. They were blood-stained and compactly folded and packed in the baskets. The sword handlers opened the heavy leather sword cases so the red-wrapped hilts of the sheaf of swords showed as the leather case leaned against the fence. They unfolded the dark-stained red flannel of the muletas and fixed batons in them to spread the stuff and give the matador something to hold. Brett watched it all. She was absorbed in the professional details.
"He's his name, stenciled on all the capes and muletas," she said. "Why do they call them muletas?"
"I don't know. I wonder if they ever launder them."
"I don't think so. It might spoil the color."
"The blood must stiffen them," Bill said.
"Funny," Brett said, "how one doesn't mind the blood."
Below in the narrow passage of the callejón, the sword handlers arranged everything. All the seats were full. Above, all the boxes were full. There was not an empty seat except in the president's box. When he came in, the fight would start. Across the smooth sand and the high doorway that led into the corrals, the bullfighters were standing, their arms furled in their capes, talking, waiting for the signal to march in across the arena. Brett was watching them with the glasses.
Here, would you like to look?
I looked through the glasses and saw the three matadors. Romero was in the center, Belmonte on his left, Martial on his right. Back of them were their people, and behind the banderilleros, back in the passageway and in the open space of the corral, I saw the picadors. Romero was wearing a black suit. His tri-cornered hat was low down over his eyes. I could not see his face clearly under the hat, but it looked badly marked. He was looking straight ahead. Martial was smoking a cigarette guardedly, holding it in his hand. Belmonte looked ahead, his face wan and yellow, his long wolf jaw out. He was looking at nothing. Neither he nor Romero seemed to have anything in common with the others. They were all alone. The president came in. There was hand clapping above us in the grandstand, and I handed the glasses to Brett. There was applause. The music started. Brett looked through the glasses. "Here, take them," she said. Through the glasses I saw Belmonte speak to Romero. Martial straightened up and dropped his cigarette, and looking straight ahead, their heads back, their free arms swinging, the three matadors walked out. Behind them came all the procession, opening out, all striding in step, all the capes furled, everybody with free arms swinging, and behind rode the picadors, their picks rising like lances. Behind all came the two trains of mules and the bullring servants. The matadors bowed, holding their hats on, before the president's box, and then came over to the barrera below us. Pedro Romero took off his heavy gold-brocaded cape and handed it over the fence to his sword handler. He said something to the sword handler. Close below us, we saw Romero's lips were puffed, both eyes were discolored. His face was discolored and swollen. The sword handler took the cape, looked up at Brett, and came over to us and handed up the cape. "Spread it out in front of you," I said. Brett leaned forward. The cape was heavy and smoothly stiff with gold. The sword handler looked back, shook his head, and said something. A man beside me leaned over toward Brett.
"He doesn't want you to spread it," he said. "You should fold it and keep it in your lap."
Brett folded the heavy cape. Romero did not look up at us. He was speaking to Belmonte. Belmonte had sent his formal cape over to some friends. He looked across at them and smiled, his wolf smile that was only with the mouth. Romero leaned over the barrera and asked for the water jug. The sword handler brought it, and Romero poured water over the percale of his fighting cape and then scuffed the lower folds in the sand with his slippered foot.
"What's that for?" Brett asked.
"To give it weight in the wind."
"His face looks bad," Bill said.
"He feels very badly," Brett said. "He should be in bed."
The first bull was Belmonte's. Belmonte was very good, but because he got 30,000 pesetas and people had stayed in line all night to buy tickets to see him, the crowd demanded that he should be more than very good. Belmonte's great attraction is working close to the bull. In bullfighting, they speak of the terrain of the bull and the terrain of the bullfighter. As long as a bullfighter stays in his own terrain, he is comparatively safe. Each time he enters into the terrain of the bull, he is in great danger. Belmonte, in his best days, worked always in the terrain of the bull. This way he gave the sensation of coming tragedy. People went to the corrida to see Belmonte, to be given tragic sensations, and perhaps to see the death of Belmonte. 15 years ago, they said if you wanted to see Belmonte, you should go quickly while he was still alive. Since then, he has killed more than 1,000 bulls. When he retired, the legend grew up about how his bullfighting had been, and when he came out of retirement, the public were disappointed, because no real man could work as close to the bulls as Belmonte was supposed to have done, not, of course, even Belmonte. Also, Belmonte imposed conditions and insisted that his bulls should not be too large, nor too dangerously armed with horns, and so the element that was necessary to give the sensation of tragedy was not there. And the public, who wanted three times as much from Belmonte, who was sick with a fistula as Belmonte had ever been able to give, felt defrauded and cheated, and Belmonte's jaw came further out in contempt, and his face turned yellower, and he moved with greater difficulty as his pain increased, and finally the crowd were actively against him, and he was utterly contemptuous and indifferent. He had meant to have a great afternoon, and instead it was an afternoon of sneers, shouted insults, and finally a volley of cushions and pieces of bread and vegetables thrown down at him in the plaza where he had had his greatest triumphs. His jaw only went further out. Sometimes he turned to smile that toothed, long-jawed, lipless smile when he was called something particularly insulting,
and always the pain that any movement produced grew stronger and stronger, until finally his yellow face was parchment color, and after his second bull was dead and the throwing of bread and cushions was over, after he had saluted the president with the same wolf-jawed smile and contemptuous eyes, and handed his sword over the barrera to be wiped and put back in its case, he passed through into the callejon and leaned on the barrera below us, his head on his arms, not seeing, not hearing anything, only going through his pain. When he looked up finally, he asked for a drink of water. He swallowed a little, rinsed his mouth, spat the water, took his cape, and went back into the ring. Because they were against Belmonte, the public were for Romero. From the moment he left the barrera and went toward the bull, they applauded him. Belmonte watched Romero, too, watched him always without seeming to. He paid no attention to Martial. Martial was the sort of thing he knew all about. He had come out of retirement to compete with Martial, knowing it was a competition gained in advance. He had expected to compete with Martial and the other stars of the decadence of bullfighting, and he knew that the sincerity of his own bullfighting would be so set off by the false aesthetics of the bullfighters of the decadent period that he would only have to be in the ring. His return from retirement had been spoiled by Romero. Romero did always, smoothly, calmly, and beautifully, what he, Belmonte, could only bring himself to do now sometimes. The crowd felt it, even the people from Biarritz, even the American ambassador saw it, finally. It was a competition that Belmonte would not enter because it would lead only to a bad horn wound or death. Belmonte was no longer well enough. He no longer had his greatest moments in the bullring. He was not sure that there were any great moments. Things were not the same, and now life only came in flashes. He had flashes of the old greatness with his bulls, but they were not of value because he had discounted them in advance when he had picked the bulls out for their safety, getting out of a motor and leaning on a fence, looking over at the herd on the ranch of his friend, the bull breeder. So he had two small, manageable bulls without much horns, and when he felt the greatness again coming, just a little of it through the pain that was always with him, it had been discounted and sold in advance, and it did not give him a good feeling. It was the greatness, but it did not make bullfighting wonderful to him anymore. Pedro Romero had the greatness. He loved bullfighting, and I think he loved the bulls, and I think he loved Brett. Everything of which he could control the locality, he did in front of her all that afternoon. Never once did he look up. He made it stronger that way, and did it for himself, too, as well as for her. Because he did not look up to ask if it pleased, he did it all for himself inside, and it strengthened him. And yet he did it for her, too. But he did not do it for her at any loss to himself. He gained by it all through the afternoon. His first quite was directly below us. The three matadors take the bull in turn after each charge he makes at a picador. Belmonte was the first. Martial was the second. Then came Romero. The three of them were standing at the left of the horse. The picador, his hat down over his eyes, the shaft of his pick angling sharply toward the bull, kicked in the spurs and held them, and with the reins in his left hand walked the horse forward toward the bull. The bull was watching. Seemingly he watched the white horse, but really he watched the triangular steel point of the pick. Romero, watching, saw the bull start to turn his head. He did not want to charge. Romero flicked his cape so the color caught the bull's eye. The bull charged with the reflex, charged and found not the flash of color but a white horse, and a man leaned far over the horse, shot the steel point of the long hickory shaft into the hump of muscle on the bull's shoulder, and pulled his horse sideways as he pivoted on the pick, making a wound, and forcing the iron into the bull's shoulder, making him bleed for Belmonte. The bull did not insist under the iron. He did not really want to get at the horse. He turned, and the group broke apart, and Romero was taking him out with his cape. He took him out softly and smoothly, and then stopped, and, standing squarely in front of the bull, offered him the cape. The bull's tail went up, and he charged, and Romero moved his arms ahead of the bull, wheeling, his feet firmed. The dampened, mud-weighted cape swung open and full as a sail fills, and Romero pivoted with it just ahead of the bull. At the end of the pass, they were facing each other again. Romero smiled. The bull wanted it again, and Romero's cape filled again, this time on the other side. Each time he let the bull pass so close that the man in the bull and the cape that filled and pivoted ahead of the bull were all one sharply etched mass. It was all so slow and so controlled.
It was as though he were rocking the bull to sleep. He made four Veronicas like that, and finished with a half Veronica that turned his back on the bull and came away toward the applause, his hand on his hip, his cape on his arm, and the bull watching his back going away. In his own bulls he was perfect. His first bull did not see well. After the first two passes with the cape, Romero knew exactly how bad the vision was impaired. He worked accordingly. It was not brilliant bullfighting, it was only perfect bullfighting. The crowd wanted the bull changed. They made a great row. Nothing very fine could happen with a bull that could not see the lures, but the president would not order him replaced.
"Why don't they change him?" Brett asked.
"They've paid for him. They don't want to lose their money."
"It's hardly fair to Romero. Watch how he handles a bull that can't see the color." "It's the sort of thing I don't like to see."
It was not nice to watch if you cared anything about the person who was doing it. With the bull who could not see the colors of the capes or the scarlet flannel of the muleta, Romero had to make the bull consent with his body. He had to get so close that the bull saw his body and would start for it, and then shift the bull's charge to the flannel and finish out the pass in the classic manner. The Biarritz crowd did not like it. They thought Romero was afraid, and that was why he gave that little sidestep each time as he transferred the bull's charge from his own body to the flannel. They preferred Belmonte's imitation of himself or Martial's imitation of Belmonte. There were three of them in the row behind us.
"What's he afraid of the bull for? The bull's so dumb he only goes after the cloth."
"He's just a young bullfighter. He hasn't learned it yet."
"But I thought he was fine with the cape before."
"Probably he's nervous now." Out in the center of the ring, all alone, Romero was going on with the same thing, getting so close that the bull could see him plainly, offering the body, offering it again a little closer, the bull watching dully, then so close that the bull thought he had him, offering again and finally drawing the charge, and then, just before the horns came, giving the bull the red cloth to follow with that little, almost imperceptible jerk that so offended the critical judgment of the Biarritz bullfight experts.
"He's going to kill now," I said to Brett. "The bull's still strong. He wouldn't wear himself out."
Out in the center of the ring, Romero profiled in front of the bull, drew the sword out from the folds of the muleta, rose on his toes, and sighted along the blade. The bull charged as Romero charged. Romero's left hand dropped the muleta over the bull's muzzle to blind him. His left shoulder went forward between the horns as the sword went in, and for just an instant he and the bull were one. Romero way out over the bull, the right arm extended high up to where the hilt of the sword had gone in between the bull's shoulders. Then the figure was broken. There was a little jolt as Romero came clear, and then he was standing, one hand up, facing the bull, his shirt ripped out from under his sleeve, the white blowing in the wind, and the bull, the red sword hilt tight between his shoulders, his head going down and his legs settling.
"There he goes," Bill said.
Romero was close enough so the bull could see him. His hand still up, he spoke to the bull. The bull gathered himself, then his head went forward and he went over slowly, then all over, suddenly, 4 feet in the air. They handed the sword to Romero, and carrying it blade down, the muleta in his other hand, he walked over to in front of the president's box, bowed, straightened, and came over to the Barrera and handed over the sword and muleta.
"Bad one," said the sword handler.
"He made me sweat," said Romero. He wiped off his face. The sword handler handed him the water jug. Romero wiped his lips. It hurt him to drink out of the jug. He did not look up at us. Martial had a big day. They were still applauding him when Romero's last bull came in. It was the bull that had sprinted out and killed the man in the morning running. During Romero's first bull, his hurt face had been very noticeable. Everything he did showed it. All the concentration of the awkwardly delicate working with the bull that could not see well brought it out. The fight with Cohn had not touched his spirit, but his face had been smashed and his body hurt. He was wiping all that out now. Each thing that he did with this bull wiped that out a little cleaner. It was a good bull, a big bull, and with horns, and it turned and recharged easily and surely. He was what Romero wanted in bulls. When he had finished his work with the muleta and was ready to kill, the crowd made him go on. They did not want the bull killed yet. They did not want it to be over. Romero went on. It was like a course in bullfighting. all the passes he linked up, all completed, all slow, templed, and smooth. There were no tricks and no mystifications. There was no brusqueness. And each pass, as it reached the summit, gave you a sudden ache inside. The crowd did not want it ever to be finished. The bull was squared on all 4 feet to be killed, and Romero killed directly below us. He killed not as he had been forced to by the last bull, but as he wanted to. He profiled directly in front of the bull, drew the sword out of the folds of the muleta, and sighted along the blade. The bull watched him. Romero spoke to the bull and tapped one of his feet. The bull charged, and Romero waited for the charge, the muleta held low, sighting along the blade, his feet firm. Then, without taking a step forward, he became one with the bull. The sword was in high between the shoulders. The bull had followed the low-swung flannel that disappeared as Romero lurched clear to the left, and it was over. The bull tried to go forward. His legs commenced to settle. He swung from side to side, hesitated, then went down on his knees, and Romero's older brother leaned forward behind him and drove a short knife into the bull's neck at the base of the horns. The first time he missed. He drove the knife in again, and the bull went over, twitching and rigid. Romero's brother, holding the bull's horn in one hand, the knife in the other, looked up at the president's box. Handkerchiefs were waving all over the bull ring. The president looked down from the box and waved his handkerchief. The brother cut the notched black ear from the dead bull and trotted over with it to Romero. The bull lay heavy and black on the sand, his tongue out. Boys were running toward him from all parts of the arena, making a little circle around him. They were starting to dance around the bull. Romero took the ear from his brother and held it up toward the president. The president bowed, and Romero, running to get ahead of the crowd, came toward us. He leaned up against the barrera and gave the ear to Brett. He nodded his head and smiled. The crowd were all about him. Brett held down the cape. "You liked it?" Romero called. Brett did not say anything. They looked at each other and smiled. Brett had the ear in her hand. "Don't get bloody," Romero said and grinned. The crowd wanted him. Several boys shouted at Brett. The crowd was the boys, the dancers, and the drunks. Romero turned and tried to get through the crowd. They were all around him, trying to lift him and put him on their shoulders. He fought and twisted away and started running in the midst of them toward the exit. He did not want to be carried on people's shoulders, but they held him and lifted him. It was uncomfortable, and his legs were spraddled, and his body was very sore. They were lifting him and all running toward the gate. He had his hand on somebody's shoulder. He looked around at us apologetically. The crowd, running, went out the gate with him. We all three went back to the hotel. Brett went upstairs. Bill and I sat in the downstairs dining room and ate some hard-boiled eggs and drank several bottles of beer. Belmonte came down in his street clothes with his manager and two other men. They sat at the next table and ate. Belmonte ate very little. They were leaving on the 7 o'clock train for Barcelona. Belmonte wore a blue striped shirt and a dark suit and ate soft-boiled eggs. The others ate a big meal. Belmonte did not talk. He only answered questions. Bill was tired after the bullfight. So was I. We both took a bullfight very hard. We sat and ate the eggs, and I watched Belmonte and the people at his table. The men with him were tough-looking and businesslike. "Come on over to the cafe," Bill said. "I want an absinthe." It was the last day of the fiesta. Outside it was beginning to be cloudy again. The square was full of people, and the fireworks experts were making up their set pieces for the night and covering them over with beech branches. Boys were watching. We passed stands of rockets with long bamboo stems. Outside the cafe there was a giant crowd. The music and the dancing were going on. The giants and the dwarfs were passing. "Where's Edna?" I asked Bill. "I don't know." We watched the beginning of the evening of the last night of the fiesta. The absinthe made everything seem better. I drank it without sugar in the dripping glass, and it was pleasantly bitter. "I feel sorry about Cohn," Bill said. "He had an awful time." "Oh, to hell with Cohn," I said. "Where do you suppose he went?" "Up to Paris." "What do you suppose he'll do?" "Oh, to hell with him." "What do you suppose he'll do?" "Pick up with his old girl, probably." "Who was his old girl?" "Somebody named Francis." We had another absinthe. When do you go back? I asked.
Tomorrow.
After a little while, Bill said, Well, it was a swell fiesta.
Yes, I said, something doing all the time.
You wouldn't believe it. It's like a wonderful nightmare.
Sure, I said, I'd believe anything, including nightmares.
What's the matter? Feel low?
Low as hell.
Have another absinthe. Here, waiter, another absinthe for this senor.
I feel like hell, I said.
Drink that, said Bill. Drink it slow.
It was beginning to get dark. The fiesta was going on. I began to feel drunk, but I did not feel any better.
How do you feel?
I feel like hell.
Have another?
It won't do any good.
Try it. You can't tell. Maybe this is the one that gets it. Hey, waiter, another absinthe for this senor.
I poured the water directly into it and stirred it instead of letting it drip. Bill put in a lump of ice. I stirred the ice around with a spoon in the brownish, cloudy mixture.
How is it?
Fine.
Don't drink it fast that way. It'll make you sick.
I set down the glass. I had not meant to drink it fast.
I feel tight.
You ought to.
That's what you wanted, wasn't it?
Sure, get tight. Get over your damn depression.
Well, I'm tight. Is that what you want?
Sit down.
I won't sit down, I said. I'm going over to the hotel.
I was very drunk. I was drunker than I ever remembered having been. At the hotel, I went upstairs. Brett's door was open. I put my head in the room. Mike was sitting on the bed. He waved a bottle.
Jake, he said. Come in, Jake.
I went in and sat down. The room was unstable unless I looked at some fixed point.
Brett, you know, she's gone off with the bullfighter chap.
No.
Yes, she looked for you to say goodbye. They went on the 7 o'clock train.
Did they?
Bad thing to do, Mike said. She shouldn't have done it.
No.
Have a drink. Wait while I ring for some beer.
I'm drunk, I said. I'm going in and lie down.
Are you blind? I was blind myself.
Yes, I said, I'm blind.
Well, bungo, Mike said. Get some sleep, old Jake.
I went out the door and into my own room and lay on the bed. The bed went sailing off, and I sat up in bed and looked at the wall to make it stop. Outside in the square, the fiesta was going on. It did not mean anything. Later, Bill and Mike came in to get me to go down and eat with them. I pretended to be asleep.
He's asleep. Better let him alone.
He's blind as a tick, Mike said. They went out. I got up and went to the balcony and looked out at the dancing in the square. The world was not wheeling anymore. It was just very clear and bright and inclined to blur at the edges. I washed, brushed my hair. I looked strange to myself in the glass and went downstairs to the dining room.
Here he is, said Bill. Good old Jake. I knew you wouldn't pass out.
Hello, you old drunk, Mike said.
I got hungry and woke up.
Eat some soup, Bill said. The three of us sat at the table, and it seemed as though about 6 people were missing.
Book 3, Chapter 19, the last chapter. In the morning it was all over. The fiesta was finished. I woke about 9 o'clock, had a bath, dressed, and went downstairs. The square was empty and there were no people on the streets. A few children were picking up rocket sticks in the square. The cafes were just opening and the waiters were carrying out the comfortable white wicker chairs and arranging them around the marble-topped tables in the shade of the arcade. They were sweeping the streets and sprinkling them with a hose. I sat in one of the wicker chairs and leaned back comfortably. The waiter was in no hurry to come. The white paper announcements of the unloading of the bulls and the big schedules of special trains were still up on the pillars of the arcade. A waiter wearing a blue apron came out with a bucket of water and a cloth and commenced to tear down the notices, pulling the paper off in strips and washing and rubbing away the paper that stuck to the stone. The fiesta was over. I drank a coffee and after a while Bill came over. I watched him come walking across the square. He sat down at the table and ordered a coffee.
Well, he said, it's all over.
Yes, I said, when do you go?
I don't know. We better get a car, I think.
Aren't you going back to Paris?
No, I can stay away another week. I think I'll go to San Sebastian.
I want to get back.
What's Mike going to do?
He's going to Saint-Jean-de-Luz. Let's get a car and all go as far as Bayonne. You can get the train from there tonight.
Good. Let's go after lunch.
All right, I'll get the car. We had lunch and paid the bill. Montoya did not come near us. One of the maids brought the bill. The car was outside. The chauffeur piled and strapped the bags on top of the car and put them in beside him in the front seat, and we got in. The car went out of the square, along through the side streets, out under the trees and down the hill and away from Pamplona. It did not seem like a very long ride. Mike had a bottle of Fundador. I only took a couple of drinks. We came over the mountains and out of Spain and down the white roads and through the overfoliaged, wet, green Basque country and finally into Bayonne. We left Bill's baggage at the station and he bought a ticket to Paris. His train left at 7:10. We came out of the station. The car was standing out in front.
"What should we do about the car?" Bill asked.
"Oh, bother the car," Mike said. "Let's just keep the car with us."
"All right," Bill said. "Where should we go?"
"Let's go to Biarritz and have a drink."
"Old Mike the Spender," Bill said.
We drove into Biarritz and left the car outside a very Ritz place. We went into the bar and sat on high stools and drank a whiskey and soda.
"That drink's mine," Mike said. "Let's roll for it."
So we rolled poker dice out of a deep leather dice cup. Bill was out first roll. Mike lost to me and handed the bartender a 100-franc note. The whiskies were 12 francs apiece. We had another round and Mike lost again. Each time he gave the bartender a good tip. In a room off the bar there was a good jazz band playing. It was a pleasant bar. We had another round. I went out on the first roll with 4 kings. Bill and Mike rolled. Mike won the first roll with 4 jacks. Bill won the second. On the final roll, Mike had 3 kings and let them stay. He handed the dice cup to Bill. Bill rattled them and rolled, and there were 3 kings, an ace, and a queen.
"It's yours, Mike," Bill said. "Old Mike the gambler."
"I'm so sorry," Mike said. "I can't get it."
"What's the matter?"
"I've no money," Mike said. "I'm stony. I've just 20 francs. Here, take 20 francs.
Bill's face sort of changed.
"I just had enough to pay Montoya. Damned lucky to have it, too."
"I'll cash you a check," Bill said.
"That's damned nice of you, but you see, I can't write checks."
"What are you going to do for money?"
"Oh, some will come through. I've 2 weeks' allowance. Should be here. I can live on tick at this pub in Saint-Jean."
"What do you want to do about the car?" Bill asked me.
"Do you want to keep it on?"
"It doesn't make any difference. Seems sort of idiotic."
"Come on, let's have another drink," Mike said.
"Fine. This one is on me," Bill said.
"Has Brett any money?"
He turned to Mike.
"I shouldn't think so. She put up most of what I gave to old Montoya."
"She hasn't any money with her?" I asked.
"I shouldn't think so. She never has any money. She gets 500 quid a year and pays 350 of it in interest to Jews."
"I suppose they get it at the source," said Bill.
"Quiet. They're not really Jews. We just call them Jews. They're Scotsmen, I believe."
"Hasn't she any at all with her?" I asked.
"I hardly think so. She gave it all to me when she left."
"Well," Bill said, "we might as well have another drink."
"Damn good idea," Mike said. "One never gets anywhere by discussing finances."
"No," said Bill.
Bill and I rolled for the next 2 rounds. Bill lost and paid. We went out to the car.
"Anywhere you'd like to go, Mike?" Bill asked.
"Let's take a drive. It might do my credit good. Let's drive about a little."
"Fine. I'd like to see the coast. Let's drive down toward Andey."
"I haven't any credit along the coast."
"You can't ever tell," said Bill.
We drove out along the coast road. There was the green of the headlands, the white, red-roofed villas, patches of forest, and the ocean very blue with the tide out and the water curling far out along the beach. We drove through Saint-Jean-de-Luz and passed through villages farther down the coast. Back of the rolling country we were going through, we saw the mountains we had come over from Pamplona. The road went on ahead. Bill looked at his watch. It was time for us to go back. He knocked on the glass and told the driver to turn around. The driver backed the car out into the grass to turn it. In back of us were the woods, below a stretch of meadow, then the sea. At the hotel where Mike was going to stay in Saint-Jean, we stopped the car and he got out. The chauffeur carried in his bags.
Mike stood by the side of the car.
"Goodbye, you chaps," Mike said. "It was a damned fine fiesta."
"So long, Mike," Bill said.
"I'll see you around," I said.
"Don't worry about money," Mike said. "You can pay for the car, Jake, and I'll send you my share."
"So long, Mike."
"So long, you chaps. You've been damned nice."
We all shook hands.
We waved from the car to Mike. He stood in the road watching.
We got to Bayonne just before the train left. A porter carried Bill's bags in from the consigne. I went as far as the inner gate to the tracks.
"So long, fella," Bill said.
"So long, kid."
"It was swell. I've had a swell time."
"Will you be in Paris?"
"No, I have to sail on the 17th.
"So long, fella."
"So long, old kid."
He went in through the gate to the train. The porter went ahead with the bags. I watched the train pull out. Bill was at one of the windows. The window passed, the rest of the train passed, and the tracks were empty. I went outside to the car.
"How much do we owe you?" I asked the driver.
The price to Bayonne had been fixed at 150 pesetas.
200 pesetas.
"How much more will it be if you drive me to San Sebastian on your way back?"
50 pesetas.
"Don't kid me."
35 pesetas.
"It's not worth it," I said. "Drive me to the Hotel Panier Fleuri."
At the hotel, I paid the driver and gave him a tip. The car was powdered with dust. I rubbed the rod case through the dust. It seemed the last thing that connected me with Spain and the fiesta. The driver put the car in gear and went down the street. I watched it turn off to take the road to Spain. I went into the hotel and they gave me a room. It was the same room I had slept in when Bill and Cone and I were in Bayonne. That seemed a very long time ago. I washed, changed my shirt, and went out in the town. At a newspaper kiosk, I bought a copy of the New York Herald and sat in a cafe to read it. It felt strange to be in France again. There was a safe suburban feeling. I wished I had gone up to Paris with Bill, except that Paris would have meant more fiesta-ing. I was through with fiestas for a while. It would be quiet in San Sebastian. The season does not open there until August. I could get a good hotel room and read and swim. There was a fine beach there. There were wonderful trees along the promenade above the beach, and there were many children sent down with their nurses before the season opened. In the evening there would be band concerts under the trees across from the Café Marinas. I could sit in the marinas and listen.
"How does one eat inside?" I asked the waiter. Inside the café was a restaurant.
"Well, very well. One eats very well."
"Good." I went in and ate dinner. It was a big meal for France, but it seemed very carefully apportioned after Spain. I drank a bottle of wine for company. It was a Chateau Margaux. It was pleasant to be drinking slowly and to be tasting the wine and to be drinking alone. A bottle of wine was good company. Afterward, I had coffee. The waiter recommended a Basque liqueur called Itzara. He brought in the bottle and poured a liqueur glass full. He said Itzara was made of the flowers of the Pyrenees, the veritable flowers of the Pyrenees. It looked like hair oil and smelled like Italian Strega. I told him to take the flowers of the Pyrenees away and bring me a Vieux Marc. The Marc was good. I had a second Marc after the coffee. The waiter seemed a little offended about the flowers of the Pyrenees, so I overtipped him. That made him happy. It felt comfortable to be in a country where it is so simple to make people happy. You can never tell whether a Spanish waiter will thank you. Everything is on such a clear financial basis in France. It is the simplest country to live in. No one makes things complicated by becoming your friend for any obscure reason. If you want people to like you, you have only to spend a little money. I spent a little money and the waiter liked me. He appreciated my valuable qualities. He would be glad to see me back. I would dine there again sometime, and he would be glad to see me and would want me at his table. It would be a sincere liking because it would have a sound basis. I was back in France. Next morning, I tipped everyone a little too much at the hotel to make more friends and left on the morning train for San Sebastian. At the station, I did not tip the porter more than I should because I did not think I would ever see him again. I only wanted a few good French friends in Bayonne to make me welcome in case I should come back there again. I knew that if they remembered me, their friendship would be loyal. At Irun, we had to change trains and show passports. I hated to leave France. Life was so simple in France.
I felt I was a fool to be going back into Spain. In Spain you could not tell about anything. I felt like a fool to be going back into it, but I stood in line with my passport, opened my bags for the customs, bought a ticket, went through a gate, climbed onto the train, and after 40 minutes and 8 tunnels, I was at San Sebastian. Even on a hot day, San Sebastian has a certain early morning quality. The trees seem as though their leaves were never quite dry. The streets feel as though they had just been sprinkled. It is always cool and shady on certain streets on the hottest day. I went to a hotel in the town where I'd stopped before, and they gave me a room with a balcony that opened out above the roofs of the town. There was a green mountainside beyond the roofs. I unpacked my bags and stacked my books on the table beside the head of the bed, put out my shaving things, hung up some clothes in the big armoire, and made up a bundle for the laundry. Then I took a shower in the bathroom and went down to lunch. Spain had not changed to summertime, so I was early. I set my watch again. I had recovered an hour by coming to San Sebastian. As I went into the dining room, the concierge brought me a police bulletin to fill out. I signed it and asked him for 2 telegraph forms and wrote a message to the Hotel Montoya telling them to forward all mail and telegrams for me to this address. I calculated how many days I would be in San Sebastian and then wrote out a wire to the office asking them to hold mail but forward all wires for me to San Sebastian for 6 days. Then I went in and had lunch. After lunch, I went up to my room, read a while, and went to sleep. When I woke, it was 4:30. I found my swimming suit, wrapped it with a comb and a towel, and went downstairs and walked up the streets to the Concha. The tide was about halfway out. The beach was smooth and firm, and the sand yellow. I went into a bathing cabin, undressed, put on my suit, and walked across the smooth sand to the sea. The sand was warm under bare feet. There were quite a few people in the water and on the beach. Out beyond, where the headlands of the Concha almost met to form the harbor, there was a white line of breakers and the open sea. Although the tide was going out, there were a few slow rollers. They came in like undulations in the water, gathered weight of water, and then broke smoothly on the warm sand. I waded out. The water was cold. As a roller came, I dove, swam under the water, and came to the surface with all the chill gone. I swam out to the raft, pulled myself up, and lay on the hot planks. A boy and girl were at the other end. The girl had undone the top strap of her bathing suit and was browning her back. The boy lay face downward on the raft and talked to her. She laughed at things he said and turned her brown back in the sun. I lay on the raft in the sun until I was dry. Then I tried several dives. I dove deep once, swimming down to the bottom. I swam with my eyes open and it was green and dark. The raft made a dark shadow. I came out of the water beside the raft, pulled up, dove once more, holding it for length, then swam ashore. I lay on the beach until I was dry, then went into the bathing cabin, took off my suit, sloshed myself with fresh water, and rubbed dry. I walked around the harbor under the trees to the casino, and then up one of the cool streets to the Café Marinas. There was an orchestra playing inside the café, and I went out on the terrace and enjoyed the fresh coolness in the hot day, and had a glass of lemon juice and shaved ice, and then a long whiskey and soda. I sat in front of the marinas for a long time and read and watched the people and listened to the music. Later, when it began to get dark, I walked around the harbor and out along the promenade, and finally back to the hotel for supper. There was a bicycle race on, the Tour du Pays Basque, and the riders were stopping that night in San Sebastian. In the dining room, at one side, there was a long table of bicycle riders eating with their trainers and managers. They were all French and Belgians and paid close attention to their meal, but they were having a good time. At the head of the table were 2 good-looking French girls, with much Rue du Faubourg Montmartre chic. I could not make out whom they belonged to. They all spoke in slang at the long table, and there were many private jokes and some jokes at the far end that were not repeated when the girls asked to hear them. The next morning at 5 o'clock, the race resumed with the last lap, San Sebastian-Bilbao. The bicycle riders drank much wine and were burned and browned by the sun. They did not take the race seriously except among themselves. They had raced among themselves so often that it did not make much difference who won, especially in a foreign country. The money could be arranged. The man who had a matter of 2 minutes lead in the race had an attack of boils, which were very painful. He sat on the small of his back.
His neck was very red and the blonde hairs were sunburned. The other riders joked him about his boils. He tapped on the table with his fork.
"Listen," he said, "tomorrow my nose is so tight on the handlebars that the only thing touches those boils is a lovely breeze."
One of the girls looked at him down the table, and he grinned and turned red. The Spaniards, they said, did not know how to pedal. I had coffee out on the terrace with the team manager of one of the big bicycle manufacturers. He said it had been a very pleasant race and would have been worth watching if Botechia had not abandoned it at Pamplona. The dust had been bad, but in Spain the roads were better than in France. Bicycle road racing was the only sport in the world, he said. Had I ever followed the Tour de France? Only in the papers. The Tour de France was the greatest sporting event in the world. Following and organizing the road races had made him know France. Few people know France. All spring and all summer and all fall he spent on the road with bicycle road racers. Look at the number of motor cars now that followed the riders from town to town in a road race. It was a rich country and more sportif every year. It would be the most sportif country in the world. It was bicycle road racing did it, that and football. He knew France, La France sportive. He knew road racing. We had a cognac. After all, though, it wasn't bad to get back to Paris. There is only one Paname. In all the world, that is. Paris is the town the most sportif in the world. Did I know the Chope de Negre? Did I not? I would see him there sometime. I certainly would. We would drink another fiend together. We certainly would. They started at 6 o'clock, less a quarter in the morning. Would I be up for the depart? I would certainly try to. Would I like him to call me? It was very interesting. I would leave a call at the desk. He would not mind calling me. I could not let him take the trouble. I would leave a call at the desk. We said goodbye until the next morning. In the morning, when I awoke, the bicycle riders and their following cars had been on the road for 3 hours. I had coffee and the papers in bed and then dressed and took my bathing suit down to the beach. Everything was fresh and cool and damp in the early morning. Nurses in uniform and in peasant costume walked under the trees with children. The Spanish children were beautiful. Some bootblacks sat together under a tree talking to a soldier. The soldier had only one arm. The tide was in and there was a good breeze and a surf on the beach. I undressed in one of the bath cabins, crossed the narrow line of beach and went into the water. I swam out, trying to swim through the rollers, but having to dive sometimes. Then in the quiet water I turned and floated. Floating, I saw only the sky and felt the drop and lift of the swells. I swam back to the surf and coasted in, face down on a big roller, then turned and swam, trying to keep in the trough and not have a wave break over me. It made me tired swimming in the trough, and I turned and swam out to the raft. The water was buoyant and cold. It felt as though you could never sink. I swam slowly, it seemed like a long swim with the high tide, and then pulled up on the raft and sat, dripping, on the boards that were becoming hot in the sun. I looked around at the bay, the old town, the casino, the line of trees along the promenade, and the big hotels with their white porches and gold-lettered names. Off on the right, almost closing the harbor, was a green hill with a castle. The raft rocked with the motion of the water. On the other side of the narrow gap that led into the open sea was another high headland. I thought I would like to swim across the bay, but I was afraid of cramp. I sat in the sun and watched the bathers on the beach. They looked very small. After a while, I stood up, gripped with my toes on the edge of the raft as it tipped with my weight, and dove cleanly and deeply to come up through the lightening water, blew the salt water out of my head, and swam slowly and steadily into shore. After I was dressed and had paid for the bath cabin, I walked back to the hotel. The bicycle racers had left several copies of Loto around, and I gathered them up in the reading room and took them out and sat in an easy chair in the sun to read about and catch up on French sporting life. While I was sitting there, the concierge came out with a blue envelope in his hand. "A telegram for you, sir." I poked my finger along under the fold that was fastened down, spread it open, and read it. It had been forwarded from Paris. "Could you come Hotel Montana, Madrid? Am rather in trouble, Brett."
I tipped the concierge and read the message again. A postman was coming along the sidewalk. He turned in the hotel. He had a big mustache and looked very military. He came out of the hotel again. The concierge was just behind him. "Here's another telegram for you, sir." "Thank you," I said. I opened it. It was forwarded from Pamplona. "Could you come, Hotel Montana, Madrid, am rather in trouble, Brett." The concierge stood there, waiting for another tip, probably. "What time is there a train for Madrid?" "It left at 9 this morning. There is a slow train at 11 and the Sud Express at 10 tonight." "Get me a berth on the Sud Express. You want the money now?" "Just as you wish," he said. "I will have it put on the bill."
"Do that."
Well, that meant San Sebastian all shot to hell. I suppose, vaguely, I had expected something of the sort. I saw the concierge standing in the doorway. "Bring me a telegram form, please." He brought it, and I took out my fountain pen and printed, "Lady Ashley, Hotel Montana, Madrid, arriving Sud Express tomorrow, love, Jake." That seemed to handle it. That was it. Send a girl off with one man, introduce her to another to go off with him, now go and bring her back, and sign the wire with love. That was it, all right. I went in to lunch. I did not sleep much that night on the Sud Express. In the morning I had breakfast in the dining car and watched the rock and pine country between Avila and Escorial. I saw the Escorial out of the window, gray and long and cold in the sun, and did not give a damn about it. I saw Madrid come up over the plain, a compact white skyline on the top of a little cliff, away off across the sun-hardened country. The Norte station in Madrid is the end of the line. All trains finish there. They don't go on anywhere. Outside were cabs and taxis and a line of hotel runners. It was like a country town. I took a taxi and we climbed up through the gardens, by the empty palace and the unfinished church on the edge of the cliff, and on up until we were in the high, hot, modern town. The taxi coasted down a smooth street to the Puerta del Sol, and then through the traffic and out into the Carrera San Jeronimo. All the shops had their awnings down against the heat. The windows on the sunny side of the street were shuttered. The taxi stopped at the curb. I saw the sign, "Hotel Montana," on the second floor. The taxi driver carried the bags in and left them by the elevator. I could not make the elevator work, so I walked up. On the second floor up was a cut brass sign, "Hotel Montana." I rang, and no one came to the door. I rang again, and a maid with a sullen face opened the door. "Is Lady Ashley here?" I asked. She looked at me dully. "Is an Englishwoman here?" She turned and called someone inside. A very fat woman came to the door. Her hair was gray and stiffly oiled in scallops around her face. She was short and commanding. "Muy buenos," I said. "Is there an Englishwoman here? I would like to see this English lady." "Muy buenos. Yes, there is a female English. Certainly you can see her if she wishes to see you." "She wishes to see me." "The chica will ask her." "It is very hot." "It is very hot in the summer in Madrid."
"And how cold in the winter?"
"Yes, it is very cold in the winter." Did I want to stay myself in person in the Hotel Montana? Of that, as yet, I was undecided, but it would give me pleasure if my bags were brought up from the ground floor in order that they might not be stolen. Nothing was ever stolen in the Hotel Montana. In other fondas, yes. Not here, no. The personages of this establishment were rigidly selectioned. I was happy to hear it. Nevertheless, I would welcome the upbringal of my bags. The maid came in and said that the female English wanted to see the male English now at once. "Good," I said. "You see, it is as I said." "Clearly." I followed the maid's back down a long dark corridor. At the end, she knocked on a door.
"Hello," said Brett. "Is it you, Jake?"
"It's me."
"Come in, come in."
I opened the door. The maid closed it after me. Brett was in bed. She had just been brushing her hair and held the brush in her hand.
The room was in that disorder produced only by those who have always had servants.
"Darling," Brett said.
I went over to the bed and put my arms around her. She kissed me, and while she kissed me, I could feel she was thinking of something else. She was trembling in my arms. She felt very small.
"Darling, I've had such a hell of a time."
"Tell me about it."
"Nothing to tell. He only left yesterday. I made him go."
"Why didn't you keep him?"
"I don't know. It isn't the sort of thing one does. I don't think I hurt him any."
"You were probably damn good for him."
"He shouldn't be living with anyone. I realized that right away."
"No."
"Oh, hell," she said. "Let's not talk about it. Let's never talk about it."
"All right."
"It was rather a knock, his being ashamed of me. He was ashamed of me for a while, you know."
"No."
"Oh, yes. They ragged him about me at the cafe, I guess. He wanted me to grow my hair out. Me, with long hair, I'd look so like hell."
"It's funny."
"He said it would make me more womanly. I'd look a fright."
"What happened?"
"Oh, he got over that. He wasn't ashamed of me long."
"What was it about being in trouble?"
"I didn't know whether I could make him go, and I didn't have a sou to go away and leave him. He tried to give me a lot of money, you know. I told him I had scads of it. He knew that was a lie. I couldn't take his money, you know."
"No."
"Oh, let's not talk about it. There were some funny things, though. Do give me a cigarette."
I lit the cigarette.
"He learned his English as a waiter in Jib."
"Yes."
"He wanted to marry me, finally."
"Really?"
"Of course. I can't even marry Mike."
"Maybe he thought that would make him Lord Ashley."
"No, it wasn't that. He really wanted to marry me. So I couldn't go away from him, he said. He wanted to make sure I could never go away from him. After I'd gotten more womanly, of course."
"You ought to feel set up."
"I do. I'm all right again. He's wiped out that damn cone."
"Good."
"You know, I'd have lived with him if I hadn't seen it was bad for him. We got along damned well."
"Outside of your personal appearance."
"Oh, he'd have gotten used to that."
She put out the cigarette.
"I'm 34, you know. I'm not going to be one of these bitches that ruins children."
"No."
"I'm not going to be that way. I feel rather good, you know. I feel rather set up."
"Good." She looked away. I thought she was looking for another cigarette. Then I saw she was crying. I could feel her crying, shaking and crying. She wouldn't look up. I put my arms around her.
"Don't let's ever talk about it. Please, don't let's ever talk about it."
"Dear Brett."
"I'm going back to Mike."
I could feel her crying as I held her close.
"He's so damned nice and he's so awful. He's my sort of thing."
She would not look up. I stroked her hair. I could feel her shaking.
"I won't be one of those bitches," she said. "But, oh, Jake, please, let's never talk about it."
We left the Hotel Montana. The woman who ran the hotel would not let me pay the bill. The bill had been paid.
"Oh, well, let it go," Brett said. "It doesn't matter now."
We rode in a taxi down to the Palace Hotel, left the bags, arranged for berths on the Sud Express for the night, and went into the bar of the hotel for a cocktail. We sat on high stools at the bar while the barman shook the martinis in a large nickeled shaker. "It's funny what a wonderful gentility you get in the bar of a big hotel," I said. "Barmen and jockeys are the only people who are polite anymore. No matter how vulgar a hotel is, the bar is always nice." "It's odd. Bartenders have always been fine."
"You know," Brett said, "it's quite true. He is only 19. Isn't it amazing?"
We touched the two glasses as they stood side by side on the bar. They were coldly beaded. Outside the curtained window was the summer heat of Madrid. "I like an olive in a martini," I said to the barman.
"Right you are, sir. There you are."
"Thanks."
"I should have asked, you know."
The barman went far enough up the bar so that he would not hear our conversation. Brett had sipped from the martini as it stood on the wood. Then she picked it up. Her hand was steady enough to lift it after that first sip. Isn't it good? Isn't it a nice bar?
They're all nice bars.
You know, I didn't believe it at first. He was born in 1905. I was in school in Paris then. Think of that.
Anything you want me to think about it?
Don't be an ass. Would you buy a lady a drink?
We'll have two more martinis.
As they were before, sir.
They were very good. Brett smiled at him.
Thank you, ma'am. Well, bung-o, Brett said.
Bung-o.
You know, Brett said, he'd only been with two women before. He never cared about anything but bullfighting.
He's got plenty of time.
I don't know. He thinks it was me, not the show in general.
Well, it was you.
Yes, it was me.
I thought you weren't going to ever talk about it.
How can I help it?
You'll lose it if you talk about it.
I just talk around it. You know, I feel rather damned good, Jake.
You should.
You know, it makes one feel rather good deciding not to be a bitch.
Yes. It's sort of what we have instead of God.
Some people have God, I said, quite a lot. He never worked very well with me.
Should we have another martini?
The barman shook up two more martinis and poured them out into fresh glasses.
Where will we have lunch? I asked Brett.
The bar was cool. You could feel the heat outside through the window.
Here? Asked Brett.
It's rotten here in the hotel. Do you know a place called Bottines? I asked the barman.
Yes, sir. Would you like to have me write out the address?
Thank you. We lunched upstairs at Bottines. It is one of the best restaurants in the world. We had roast young suckling pig and drank Rioja Alta. Brett did not eat much. She never ate much. I ate a very big meal and drank three bottles of Rioja Alta.
How do you feel, Jake? Brett asked.
My God, what a meal you've eaten.
I feel fine. Do you want a dessert?
Lord, no.
Brett was smoking.
You like to eat, don't you? She said.
Yes, I said. I like to do a lot of things.
What do you like to do?
Oh, I said, I like to do a lot of things.
Don't you want a dessert?
You asked me that once, Brett said.
Yes, I said.
So I did. Let's have another bottle of Rioja Alta.
It's very good.
You haven't drunk much of it, I said.
I have. You haven't seen.
Let's get two bottles, I said.
The bottles came. I poured a little in my glass, then a glass for Brett, then filled my glass. We touched glasses.
Bung-o, Brett said.
I drank my glass and poured out another.
Brett put her hand on my arm.
Don't get drunk, Jake, she said. You don't have to.
How do you know?
Don't, she said. You'll be all right.
I'm not getting drunk, I said. I'm just drinking a little wine. I like to drink wine.
Don't get drunk, she said. Jake, don't get drunk.
Want to go for a ride, I said. Want to ride through the town?
Right, Brett said. I haven't seen Madrid. I should see Madrid.
I'll finish this, I said.
Downstairs we came out through the first floor dining room to the street. A waiter went for a taxi. It was hot and bright.
Up the street was a little square with trees and grass where there were taxis parked.
A taxi came up the street, the waiter hanging out at the side. I tipped him and told the driver where to drive and got in beside Brett. The driver started up the street. I settled back. Brett moved close to me. We sat close against each other. I put my arm around her and she rested against me comfortably. It was very hot and bright and the houses looked sharply white. We turned out onto the Gran Via.
Oh, Jake, Brett said. We could have had such a damned good time together.
Ahead was a mounted policeman in khaki directing traffic. He raised his baton. The car slowed suddenly, pressing Brett against me.
Yes, I said.
Isn't it pretty to think so?
This concludes the reading of The Sun Also Rises by Ernest Hemingway. This book was read by Alexander Adams.